Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the New Books Network. My name is Lee Pierce, your host for New Books and Language, and I am thrilled today to have Luke Winslow here discussing his new book, fresh off the presses 2020, entitled American Catastrophe, Fundamentalism, Climate Change, Gun Rights, and the Rhetoric of Donald J. Trump and a Partridge in a Pear Tree. No, I'm just kidding. That's not the title. All right. Let me tell you a little bit about the book. It's from Ohio State University Press. We are loving Ohio State University Press right now. They're putting a bunch of their books, including Luke's, in their Biblio Vault, complimentary for the pandemic. I will tell you more at the end about how to get a copy if you have a subscription, and also how to get one for your local library or a personal copy for your office shelf, which I guess is now a home office shelf. So about the book. So on the face of it, most of us would agree, right, that catastrophe is harmful, and avoiding catastrophe is key to our survival and making progress. And yet, like, we have climate change, 30,000 more Americans are killed by guns each year, and we've got Donald J. Trump, the president, creating political chaos with all of his rage tweets. And, you know, this book was written a little while ago, and still yet, even today, right, Obamagate and the Liberate Virginia, right, rage tweets, capital letters, the whole deal. So American Catastrophe explores such examples to argue that, in fact, we live in an age where catastrophe not only functions as a dominant organizing rhetoric, but further, it's an appealing and unifying force for many communities across America. So Luke Winslow is here with us today. He's going to talk about all kinds of fun concepts like rhetorical homology and how that can help us understand the way that catastrophe helps appeal and unite Americans from ecological, cultural, and different political spheres. So I'm excited to have Luke with us today. He's given me permission to call him Luke, not Dr. Winslow. Luke, are you there?
I am, yes. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. I love this book. And man, kudos to you. Do you just like, did this book come out and then every time you see Trump's Twitter, you're just like, oh, I'm so right about everything?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it kind of like it's a, as you mentioned in the title, it's a, like a dark premise, for some dark times. And so, yeah, wallowing around in some of this for so long requires, you know, you got to come up for air once in a while. So,
Yes. Well, I like to think of myself as the air and I like to think of you as the dark premise. So we will play well together today. Cause I, if you don't laugh, you cry, right? Okay. That's so right. Will you tell us more about like, who is Luke Winslow and how did the book show up? And, you know, what are you really excited for people to get out of this book?
I hope the book can equip people to, see the rhetorical dimensions of their lives in a richer, more clear way. I mean, I think that's the central purpose of a lot of what a lot of intellectuals, academics, scholars, and journalists do. You know, I'm keen on like a flashlight metaphor that my hope is the book shines a light on things that we don't fully understand, we don't fully comprehend. And of course, the presidency for many of us, the presidency of Donald Trump is just, you know, exhibit 1A for just, you know, baffling policies and baffling public conversations. But that's just one example. I was originally drawn to the topic because of climate change. And, you know, as our planet burns, Americans in particular seem unwilling or unable to do anything about it. And I wanted to know more about why. And that was the original impetus for the book. But that same kind of an idea could be applied to how Americans react and respond to gun violence. And as we, you know, talk today at the end of May, the coronavirus is another vivid example of just something that, like, on the surface is baffling and confusing. And, you know, how does the richest nation in the history of the world handle something like this so poorly that, I don't know about you, but I'm kind of drawn to those paradoxes. And that's where the book comes from. I guess I still am for another few days, a professor of rhetorical studies at San Diego State. But I'm joining the faculty at Baylor University.
I have some people I love at Baylor. That's going to be so fun for you. I'm excited.
Yeah, I am too. It's a big move. And of course, we didn't, you know, when I interviewed and got the offer and all that, I didn't know there was a global pandemic coming. So that's added some uncertainty to the whole move. But yeah, I got, you know, we're selling our house here in California now and moving out to Waco in the next couple weeks, in fact.
Wonderful. Well, for better or worse, the transition is happening. So I guess we'll just wish you the best of luck under the circumstances. To bring it back to some stuff you said, I think what I found most interesting about this book is, as you already mentioned, you drew across a lot of what, I mean, this is a really brave book because most people tend to go real deep on a single topic, right? You get one book on climate change, you get one book on gun rights. And in your case, you actually pull together, it's almost like coalition building. You show some of the common threads among these different case studies. That I think in, you know, one of the problems that they've had is like they can't form coalitions. So you see climate change people, especially we just had Earth Day April 22nd. And it was like you saw the Earth Day people trying to get some traction with other events happening and COVID, but they just kept getting kind of steamrolled by these corporate half-assed, Lego definitely believes in Earth Day, even though like there's literally nothing more damaging to climate than just like stuff like Legos, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, in terms of like as a, like, because it's a total consumer commodity, it's entirely non-sustainable, non-organic, and serves absolutely no, there's no way for it to kind of feed back into environmental support. So I really appreciated the book for being able to draw across all of those case studies. And one of the ways you do that is by talking about this concept of rhetorical homology. So I don't know if you want to talk about that or how you discovered the connections between the case studies, but that's where the book starts. And I thought just a great kicking off point for the interview.
Yeah. The book, initially, you know, the launch point is that it's a book about a problem. And the problem is that we don't have competent vocabulary to talk about some of our most pressing social, economic, and political issues. Like our words are bad. And like I said, my initial interest was like bad words about climate change. But as I got into focusing not just on ecological damage, but on how we talk about it, it seemed that there were some clear connections or patterns, these other complicated social issues. And that's where, you know, as you mentioned, you know, in the title is really unwieldy. It's hard to get out because the subtitle, Christian fundamentalism, anti-environmentalism, gun rights messaging, and the administration of Donald Trump and the partridge in the pear tree attempts to like cast this wide net because it's not a book so much about a topic as it is about the problem. And the problem is that we don't have very good words to talk about challenging social issues. So the tool that I use to illuminate those words is the rhetorical homology. And homology is not a word that we use often in our daily conversations, but I found that a helpful point of comparison is to think about a well or like an aquifer. So you have this aquifer, and the homology tries to explain how disparate, various people and organizations draw from the same aquifer. So if there's this aquifer that's defined by catastrophe, what I try to do in the book is to show how anti-environmentalists and gun rights advocates and supporters of Trump and Christian fundamentalists all draw from that same rhetorical well. Another way to say that is they're all they're disparate. You know, they're fundamentally distinct or dissimilar entities, right? Like climate change is not gun rights. But if you look closely at the patterns, the arguments, the language that they deploy, there's kind of this shared area of common ground that I refer to as catastrophe.
That's, you have quite the skill with metaphors, my friend. It's almost like you might study rhetoric.
Well, there's,
still, I appreciate it. It's you know, it's helpful, right? It's helpful to process ideas. This is like the third metaphor you've dropped in under 10 minutes. I love it.
Well, yeah, background in rhetoric, right? And more specifically, just when you're dealing with concepts like neoliberalism and, you know, rhetorical homology and ideology and hegemony, like, we can talk about that stuff, but we also have to be able to teach it to undergrads, and we also have to be able to make connections to people outside academia. So, and I'm drawing heavily from my graduate program, because I earned a PhD at the University of Texas at Austin. And when I arrived there in 2005, and I went to Texas to
study.
Were you
pre-Josh Gunn?
Josh Gunn arrived the same time I did.
Oh, to work with the love of my life.
Yeah, isn't he awesome?
Yes, my favorite.
He came as an assistant professor from LSU the same year that I arrived as a graduate student. So I didn't, you know, they kind of protected him from graduate students. So I didn't get to work too closely with him. But yeah, having him there was just wonderful.
So what does that experience do for the way that you are thinking in this book?
Well, Barry Brummett, who I went out there to work with, had written a book on rhetorical homology in 2004. And so when I arrived in 2005, he was kind of sick of the topic at the time, but I was, you know, like an eager grad student trying to make a positive impression. So I was all over, you know, his new book. And I didn't fully understand it because it's a relatively complicated concept. It took some years to really understand, but I heard him talk about the homology without using that term so much. And so your reference to metaphors and comparisons, kind of trying to learn from that if we don't use the term very much on a daily basis, well, we can draw from, like, you know, similar terms that are basically serving the same function. And so I was kind of interested in the idea because I thought it was a useful critical tool. You know, in grad school, you're always told to, you know, theorize, right? Like, no one cares about your topic. No one cares about you. The only way to have an impact is to provide some sort of larger conceptual, methodological, or theoretical contribution. And that's particularly unique to the, you know, grad school world. But I also found that the rhetorical homology was a great, you know, like opening up a toolbox, a great toolkit for understanding really pressing social challenges. And so I wrote a couple articles using the rhetorical homology, and I drew some comparisons across like grant writing and evangelical Christianity and neoliberalism. And like I said a little bit earlier, ultimately I kind of had this tool, rhetorical homology, and I found it usefully explained that, you know, broad, like you said, that broad coalition of audiences that are drawn together by catastrophe.
Yeah, and I think before we get into the more optimistic sense, which is like the potential for coalition building, you mentioned earlier that a sentence I really love, which is, in fact, I will be tweeting it later, which is that we just don't have the vocabulary to, and by don't have, I mean, sometimes it's like willingly don't choose. And sometimes just don't know is available and sometimes hasn't been invented yet. The vocabulary to think about these issues in ways that might move the needle on some solutions, right? And so do you maybe have an example, or so when did you kind of come to understand that that was a problem, or is that just something you've always known?
Well, that's a great question. I'm a Christian, and my dad is a minister, a Methodist minister, and my mom is a theology professor at Azusa Pacific University. and my grandfather.
That must have been a very interesting house to grow up in.
It was, absolutely. My grandfather was also a minister. My great-grandfather was also a minister. So I grew up very familiar with kind of American Christian public conversations. And so the idea that, now I want to be real specific with the terms, this is not what all Christians think, but there is a significant percentage of American Christians who have this apocalyptic outlook on the world that requires things to get really, really bad in order for Jesus to return, in order for the second coming. Now, me and my family reject that, but, you know, growing up in the community, I was definitely aware of it. And so that's where, you know, if you piece together this idea that you are kind of yearning for apocalyptic catastrophes with like the overwhelming scientific evidence that the world is burning, you can then start to see what we would refer to as a missing warrant. That, you know, if scientists tell us that the earth is warming, and a way to redress that warming and the catastrophe that is already happening and will continue to happen, the only way to redress that is to stop burning fossil fuels, which means we have to change public policy. We have our evidence. And we have our claim, our solution. But if you're not worried about the planet burning, if you, and all of the social, economic, and political upheaval that that will cause, well, what motivation do you have to change your behavior personally? And then collectively, what motivation do you have to support politicians and legislations that will redress climate change? And so that was I felt like a huge understudied problem in terms of our public conversations and how we talk about social problems, because there's this assumed warrant that we are all like drawn together by the best obtainable version of the truth, by shared human progress, and by our like collective aversion to catastrophe, right? We don't want 30,000 Americans to die because of gun violence. We don't want the corona pandemic to kill 100,000 Americans. We don't want the planet to burn. And so we're going to do something about it. But that whole doing something about it relies on the premise that we want shared human progress, that we want things to actually get better. And for a significant and kind of unrecognized, unacknowledged percentage of Americans, that premise is just not there. That premise is just not motivating.
Well, and that's sort of an interesting twist, because sometimes the problem is you don't have the language. And sometimes it's, you know, you have language and it is myopic in the sense that this idea of almost like wanting the impending doom because it satisfies a kind of desire, it forecloses the possibility that you could think about things from a different perspective. So that's fascinating. See,
yeah, you have the language is there to
give you one view.
Yeah, and in this case,
one solution, right?
Yeah, exactly. To paralyze you in the face of catastrophe. The language is there to, and we're hearing this right now as we talk about the coronavirus. I mean, think about the language that we use that some use to talk about the coronavirus propelling us toward becoming a better and stronger country. Donald Trump and Mike Pence talk about this. David Brooks of the New York Times talks a lot about this, that we're going to find this silver lining in terms of the coronavirus and we're going to come out of it stronger. Like, wait, hold on. Really? No. Like, our lives are all now going to be worse off and harder. And that's just for the survivors. Life is going to get worse because of this coronavirus catastrophe. And yet, from the top down, from really influential politicians and thought leaders, we have this vocabulary that just kind of forces us to focus on the good that will come out of it. And what I found is very similar words, very similar vocabularies are used to describe other, you know, catastrophic dimensions of our lives. So you're right. I mean, it's not like there is no language. The problem is there's language, but it's not language that will help us improve public policy. It's the exact opposite. It's language that will facilitate, you know, devastation.
Well, and the other thing sort of you point to is, and I love talking about this. So you talked about paradoxes earlier. I'm very attracted to paradoxes. And I think one of the things that, I grew up with a minister grandmother. And so that saturated that entire part of my family. Similar kinds of things, similar frameworks, is that they all point in one direction and they don't permit of a kind of being able to think multiple thoughts at once. And so Scott Fitzgerald wrote after the Depression, he has this great essay called The Crack Up. And I'm not in the habit of like overquoting people like Scott Fitzgerald, but he wrote in The Crack Up that the mark of an intelligent person is the ability to think two contradictory thoughts, right, and continue to move forward. And so after the Depression, you have people thinking that everything is fucked, right? And things are going to get better. And his point was like, that's what you're supposed to be thinking, because when you think both thoughts, you have to like move in ways that allow you to admit of both truths. Mm-hmm. And things like apocalyptic catastrophe thinking only admit of one truth, which is everything's bad and that's fine because we're fine if everything goes to hell.
Yeah.
But you have to be able to think it's been the worst catastrophe. Life is going to be so hard, but also focusing on the hard, you know, is only one aspect of it. There's another aspect of it, which is what are we going to do to change public policy? But the one-dimensional thinking that you talked about kind of witnessing for, you know, in one area of fundamentalist Christianity is the same one-dimensional thinking that the administration is perpetuating, which is right, resilience thinking, right? Oh yeah, we're going to bounce back stronger than ever. It's like, no, we're not.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And that doesn't mean that we can't still make policy. In fact, we need to make policy knowing that we're not going to bounce back stronger than ever.
Right. The goal is to prevent the next catastrophe. You know what I mean?
Like
our country would have been much better if we avoided the coronavirus pandemic.
Well, but I think the other piece too is I'm sorry, go ahead. I'm getting excited.
Well, yeah. And the problem is like you've mentioned that we don't have the language to talk about, you know, for example, strong institutions. International scientific collaborations. Like, can the Trump administration talk about that? No. The Trump administration can talk about, us versus them, rigid hierarchies of power, dominance, where you beat your opponent into submission. But the actual institutions and policies that we would have needed to limit the devastation of this particular pandemic simply aren't there. And what I'm suggesting is you can find those throughout other different pressing social issues too.
Yeah, well, and I think too, and I'd love to, let's get to some of those pressing social issues because I don't want to make the whole thing about me just having thoughts about pandemic. But this is a point that I repeatedly have to point out on college campuses as everyone loses their mind that we might have to be prepared to teach online and in person in the fall. And how on earth am I going to write two whole classes? It's like the pandemic didn't do this. The pandemic pointed out where things are already weak. And those are in our social safety nets. Those are in the way. And somebody wrote a really great piece I wish I had in front of me about how the pandemic has shown that our K-12 public education system in America, the only thing ever holding it together was that physical classroom. And that if you take that away, you see how totally decrepit the system is. Mm-hmm. And so when we think about bouncing back stronger than ever, and we think about resilience, what that says to me is like, oh, if the pandemic had never happened, things were going along quite ducky. And that's just not true. But of course, you know, a conservative administration isn't going to want to look at, oh, the pandemic really points to like a huge problem in the social safety net. We should probably, I don't know, like go back to the New Deal or whatever, right? They do not want to admit of those contradictions.
Yeah. I mean, the complicated thing, you mentioned paradox before. You know, rhetoricians are drawn to paradox. I think a lot of scholars are. A lot of curious people are. Right? Things that look one way on the surface, but beneath that. appear much different. And before the pandemic, and the empirical evidence is clear and overwhelming, we were living in the richest, safest, healthiest, wealthiest moment in human history. Now, last couple years, with the rise of deaths of despair, have changed some of that in America, at least. But, I mean, things weren't going along, would you say, ducky? But in terms of a lot of broader metrics, things were definitely moving in the right direction.
Oh, that's interesting. That's a good point. You do kind of point that out in the book a little bit.
Yeah.
And will you clarify what you mean, by the way, for deaths of despair? Because that's I think that's a new term for some people.
Yeah. So Angus Deaton and Anne Case have written about this. And it's deaths of despair is a phrase used to describe declining mortality rates, especially for white working class Americans. And, you know, over this long trajectory, lifespans in America have grown. And, you know, a person born in 1950 will live longer than a person born in 1940, you know, and so on. But that has only changed, I think, since 2016, 2017, where increases in particularly opioid overdoses, but also increases in suicides, hence deaths of despair, particularly among white working class Americans, have for the first time in a really long time kind of curtailed increasing lifespans. And people are drawn to that for the racial dimension, of course, but also because it's the first like significant empirically supported example of this like long-term trend where things tend to get better over time. It's the first significant hiccup in that.
Hmm. True. You're right. And again, I think that this is one of those examples where we have to hold, like, how do we hold together that things were a problem? Things were also getting better. Things might get, some stuff will get better from here, and some stuff also will. And then this is like what the rhetorical homology gives people, is it gives people a way of thinking about all those things at once without just going into analysis paralysis, right? And start thinking about like, okay, if all that's true, how do we want to create policy?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's what I hope is one of the takeaways from the book is with this critical tool, you know, with this lens that we can now see things in a richer way, you know, what do we do with it? And Trump is just a wonderful case study in how we react. There will always be Donald Trumps. There always have been. You know, he's a carnival barker. He's a buffoon. He's a clown, and that's fine.
Right.
But he can't control the levers of power like he does. He can have a reality TV show, and he can go on Howard Stern and whatever. But the problem is when he's in the White House. And so I try to draw on Kenneth Burke, probably the most prominent rhetorician of the 20th century, who developed a comic frame and a tragic frame. And the comic frame, I think, is particularly helpful for understanding how we react to not just Trump, you know, because Trump's going to be gone, but how do we react to, in this case, people that deploy that catastrophic language.
Right, which is tragic because it doesn't admit of like human folly, right?
Yes.
So when we say comedy, we don't mean funny because we mean, and I'm not telling you this, I'm telling the people listening this, right? That the tragic and comic frames are two ways of looking at human error. And in the tragic frame, human error is flawed, it's fated by the gods, it's insurmountable, right? Very much like some Christian fundamentalist catastrophe rhetoric. In the comic frame, doesn't mean stuff is funny. It means that we look at folly and human error as correctable, as contingent, as something that was made as a mistake and can be corrected. I mean, they're just different ways of looking at what it means, sort of like for human beings to be flawed and for society to be flawed. So I'm just gonna put that out there so everyone listening understands.
Yeah, that's a fantastic summary. Now take that.
I love Attitudes Toward History. It's like one of my top 10 all favorite rhetoric books. Yeah.
Yes. apply that to somebody like Wayne LaPierre, the president of the NRA, or apply that to someone like, if you think about prominent Christian fundamentalist writers like, Jerry Falwell when he was alive, or James Dobson.
I think Jordan Peterson too.
Yes. Apply that to Jordan,
which is extra problematic because he's an academic, so he's got like the double cred to peddle this kind of stuff.
Yes, but of course we know that is sometimes the connection to academia can be quite a ruse. But yeah, that's the hope then, is that you have a conceptual tool that you can apply to see the messaging of someone like Jordan Peterson and Donald Trump more clearly. And so the takeaway is, and kind of drawing on the comic frame as you defined it so well, is don't worry about attributing their motives to evilness.
Mm-hmm.
Trump's not evil, he's a clown.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
he can be a clown on the sidelines, as long as he's marginalized, as long as he's on reality TV and not guiding public policy.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is hard for people. And it's one of the things, I talk about in my book and some of my Trump work is like, you don't need to make this guy the second coming of evil to decide that his choices are shitty.
Yeah.
And I think people think that if they say things like, well, he just made a choice and he did. And if they treat him sort of like just like a person, then somehow that validates him. And it just isn't true. And as your book points out, you lose just as much. I mean, you don't gain anything by turning him into the second incarnate of evil, except reinforcing to yourself that you hate this guy, which you don't need to reinforce him. You need to find new ways to think about what to do about his presence as a political figurehead.
Yeah. And isn't that, it's so timely to have that discussion right now. I mean, we've been having it for a long time, but with an election coming up in November, we can't help but consider, like, in a real urgent way, what's the best way to respond to this guy? Because we know over the next couple months, it's going to get darker and darker and more catastrophic and just crazy. I mean, you mentioned Obamagate earlier. Mm-hmm. How does one who cares about the vitality of American democracy respond to these just blatant breaches of norms and decorum and expectations? And that's where idea. Oh, go ahead.
Oh no, I was just going to say another example, and then we really should get back to the book because there's so much stuff. We haven't talked as nearly enough about the gun stuff. We talked a lot about Trump, but I understand that's just where our mind goes.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a hashtag trending on Twitter right this second: Trump has no plan. And the argument is that he just doesn't have a plan for fighting coronavirus. And it's like, no, he has a plan. That doesn't and we need to understand the plan. And not only does he have a plan for coronavirus, he also has a plan for systemic takeover of the courts that's going to last until 2060. I don't care who's in office the next 40 years. If he gets to appoint any more district and local Supreme Court judges, I mean, we are deeply screwed. So to say Trump has no plan feels good in the moment for people that want their pound of flesh, but it really just does not get at what is happening in a complex way. And I think that's one of the big features of this book is like, you can think someone has a plan or that something has a logic and not also validate it as being right.
Yeah. Or even, go even further. Maybe Trump doesn't have a plan. Fine. You know who does?
Okay.
Mitch McConnell. And John Roberts Coke.
Right.
And
yes.
Wayne
mic
LaPierre.
Drop, Luke. Mic drop right there.
That's why I think it's important, and you know this language really well, that we understand people like Trump and Wayne LaPierre and Jerry Falwell as texts. They are public figures, right?
And I so love the, this. The, I love it. Which makes me think now of a new Twitter hashtag, which is hashtag McConnell has Trump's plan.
Yeah.
Right.
Yes.
And see what happens. We go from this binary thinking of like, oh, the man has no plan, to actually getting what is happening, and you still don't have to validate everybody. And suddenly, like, language opens up. And this is, I mean, rhetorical homology is a real gift for people. I think I don't know if you've considered pitching it to a popular outlet, timed with the book and everything happening. But this would be a great concept to bring to people in like popular news, like New York Magazine or something. It's a crucial tool. And I mean, I love it as a rhetorical concept, but I also love to see it as like just public discourse, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah. So why don't we get back to some other case studies, because, you know, we're 34 minutes in and we've hardly even hit some of the fantastic stuff in this book. So is there any discourse or thinking of like public figures as texts or discourse or controversies as texts? Is there a particular one that you want to dig your teeth into?
Yeah. So we talked about Corona because it's timely. Yes. And we talked about Trump because we just have to.
Because Trump.
Yeah. But I think gun violence is a good example.
Yeah. Let's go there. I love
and
that.
So there's a chapter in the book where we basically look real closely at what we call gun rights messaging. And it's a lot of it's from the NRA, National Rifle Association, but a lot of it's also from people like Sarah Palin and even from Donald Trump. A lot of it's looking closely at the messaging that emerged in reaction to mass shootings. So when Sandy Hook was shot up and I think 20 first graders died and five or six teachers died, you know, how that's catastrophic and tragic and just terrible. And so how does a organization so committed to gun rights like the NRA respond to an event like that? And drawing, you know, from several different examples of NRA messaging, I tried to make similar connections between their response, their catastrophic responses, their catastrophic contributions to these public conversations about guns, and this deeper catastrophic rhetorical aquifer. I'll give you an example of what I mean.
Please do. I'm excited for this.
When the prospect of a Hillary Clinton presidency loomed, the NRA was basically licking their chops because they knew that going from Obama to Hillary Clinton would maintain momentum because it would, you know, stoke the anger of a lot of their primary audience. And, you know, we use audience real specifically as a community drawn together by the messaging of the NRA, a community that wouldn't exist apart from that messaging. And the problem is Trump won, right? And because Trump won and the anger dissipated and NRA membership dropped and kind of the fire and the fuel has been sapped, because that community, a community in this case constituted by violent catastrophe, needs to define itself against a clear and present enemy. Without that enemy, it's harder to find that coherent identity. I use the example of a major gun manufacturer that experienced a baffling increase in their stock price after Sandy Hook, because the weapon that we use at Sandy Hook was also the weapon produced by this gun manufacturer. And that it's hard to talk about this, but this is the real dark underbelly of this catastrophic rhetoric, that when a weapon is used to kill young American children, that benefits the shareholders of a private equity firm that owned the manufactured that gun. And that the same comparison then to the NRA, that the NRA funding, you know, their donations and their membership increases after tragic events, after mass shootings, because it's a community constituted by catastrophe.
I know. This chapter was one of those, like, so true and insightful. It was like hard to read, right? Because it does feel a little bit. It made me want to go into almost my own like liberal version of catastrophe rhetoric, right?
It was tough to write about the one, it was fascinating to link this to some of our earlier conversations. I remember, I think it was after the Parkland shooting in Florida, Donald Trump was giving a press conference, and in his press conference, he said something to the effect of, you know, you never know how you would actually react, but I'd like to think that I would have run into this school.
Right. I would have run in. Yes, I remember this press conference.
Because if y'all recall, the security guard ran away from the school, or already hit or something like that, and he got a lot of heat from it. So Trump, in the press conference, was kind of comparing what that security guard did to what he would have done. So think about that. So he's technically obese. I think he's 72 or 73 now. He's got bone spurs that kept him out of Vietnam War. He doesn't exercise. He eats a lot of fast food. He is telling the American public that he would have run into the school to face Nicholas Cruz and his AR-15 rather than run away from it. The point is not whether he would actually do that, right? Who cares? That's not the point.
Or whether he is in fact obese, which is a conversation we are currently having that I could not care less about.
I know Nancy Pelosi. She knows how to rib him. He's so concerned with image. I mean, he's so concerned.
Part of me was like, dude, Pelosi, you're better than this. And part of me was like, you know, I'm going to give this one to you. You've earned it.
I know. I wonder about that too. I mean, a bit of a tangent, but yeah, you wrestle with a pig in the mud, you get dirty, and they like it.
Yeah,
and I know Pelosi is so experienced that she knows that stuff, but she had to just go with this one. But anyway, so we are interested in, as people that are interested in improved public conversations, is what does a man like Donald Trump get out of telling the world that he would do that? Mm-hmm. Not that he'd actually do it. But what type of identity is constructed in the utterance? Mm-hmm. And that's where we are so interested in how public words shape identity and how public words end up shaping public policy. Because he got some sort of perverse satisfaction out of that. You know what I mean? Like that helped him and helped cohere an identity for him and for his base. That, I mean, can you imagine if Obama or if Hillary Clinton would have said something like that, it wouldn't have made any sense. They wouldn't have said it and it wouldn't have made any sense. But for him, with his identity, attempting to hail a particular community into coherence, it was a powerful message.
Yeah. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, and it puts into circulation all kinds of other truth claims, including that like it would work. Right. And they've done some interesting studies about they'll put like trained officers who have been right. Because one of the big arguments for gun liberties is that, oh, well, we just provide training. Oh, the NRA does this amazing public service by providing people with gun training. But they've had like skilled law professionals and they put them under duress and have them go in, and their accuracy is like not that much better than just a rando running through a building trying to disarm or shoot someone without killing a civilian. And so it puts into circulation this truth claim about our sense of reason, our ability to think under stress, that shores up all of this gun rights activism that just does not hold up to scrutiny. But it doesn't need to, because Trump is the president and he has the ear of people who are looking for him to reinforce that all of these things are real.
Yes. And the larger connection there, from schools to just violence in general, bring a gun into your home immediately becomes less safe. And the empirical research is clear about that. Bring a gun into your home, or as you mentioned, bring a gun into a school, even for a trained professional, much less a teacher.
Give a teacher a gun and give them an online safety course. Yeah, right. Exactly.
But and so you mentioned reason in your description there. So it is unreasonable if you're concerned with, you know, keeping your family safe, or more broadly, if you're concerned with less gun violence. Mm-hmm. It is unreasonable to bring a gun into your home, mm-hmm. right? It is from one perspective, irrational. Mm-hmm. But here's where the important point is. There's a missing warrant there.
Sure,
and the missing warrant is mm-hmm. you want to reduce gun violence. And and to link this back to the NRA, NRA doesn't want to reduce gun violence. The NRA doesn't want to reduce school shootings.
No, they not at all.
More.
Yes. Right, because the NRA's warrant for is individuated, right? Their focus on is individual gun ownership, gun rights, gun purchase, gun consumerism, which of course then shores up corporate. Their warrant is not collective safety. Whereas, you know, that's like my point is, I mean, and I thought about this with toilet paper. I know it's a stupid example, but when all the toilet paper panic happened, I was like sitting in my house, like, am I going to be the person who goes and buys up all the toilet paper? I was like, no. You know what? And it doesn't matter whether they're going to run out of toilet paper or not. And it wasn't even like I convinced myself that we didn't need to. I was just like, I'm just not going to. And sure enough, there were a couple of weeks there where I couldn't get my hands on toilet paper. I made it through. We won't go into details. But then now people are trying to get like refunds on the $5,000 worth of toilet paper that they bought. And it just goes to show that like if you can just resist your base urges if you're like my father and the NRA saturates 80% of your brain, like you never even learn how to do, you do start to see that these conspiracy narratives don't play out the way that you think they're going to. And if one person might have had a gun, might have defended their family against one robber one time somewhere, but that isn't even that's just not a warrant for collective mass availability of semi-automatic rifles. But you're right. The NRA, ideologically or consciously or intentionally or otherwise, has a vested interest in mass shootings.
Yeah.
And the book lays this out so well.
Yeah. Thank you. And it's,
thank you.
to link back to what we talked about earlier, that leaves us dispirited, but I hope it doesn't leave us paralyzed. Because the next logical question for us is, for people that care about shared human progress, for people that want to reduce gun violence and reduce, a warming planet, is how do we react to this dominant part of our public conversations? How do we, in this specific case, how do we keep that catastrophic conversation from influencing public policy?
Well, and I don't know if you're planning on answering this question, but we haven't talked a lot about the anti-environmentalism that happens, ecological catastrophe. It's a big piece of the book. Do you want to maybe, as we're kind of coming up on 45 minutes, think about like how do you keep moving forward and strategize amidst sort of like the doom and gloom while thinking about some of the arguments you make about environmentalism?
Yeah, so that's a question that is, it's a fluid question. And if you follow survey data on how Americans feel about climate change or global warming, there are some interesting trends and interesting changes. But one of the things that, or one part of that survey data that is relatively consistent is even that even as people become more aware of climate change, which they are, and even as people become more aware that not only is the climate changing, but it's going to be bad when it does, which also seems to be the case, there still is a unwillingness or inability to make the next step, to take the next step and then support policies that will redress climate change. So think about that. We're aware it's happening. We're aware it's going to be really bad, but we're not willing to do anything about it. And so what I suggest in the chapter on anti-environmentalism is not a lot of people go around saying they want the planet to burn. Not a lot of people go around really directly articulating apocalyptic ecological references, especially in, you know, mainstream public conversations, right? It'd be hard even now in the Republican Party to get elected by, you know, professing your desire to warm the planet. But, and here's where the value of the rhetorical homology comes in. Mm-hmm. If there is this deeper rhetorical aquifer that you and your community is drawing from, you can accept that climate change is happening and it's going to be bad, and still not want to do anything about it, and still kind of hold together a coherent identity without feeling that, you know, cognitive dissonance that a lot of us do that actually motivates us to change our behavior. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even talking about like changing your light bulbs or driving a hybrid. That's not it.
Right.
We need public policy interventions at a national and global scale. And so when we elect someone like Trump, Mick Mulvaney put this really well, former chief of staff of Trump. He basically said that Trump's election means that we aren't going to worry about climate change. Because if the American public was worried about climate change, they wouldn't have elected Trump. And he's exactly right. So that's the point of intervention. Or we'd say that, yeah, climate change is happening. It's going to be bad. Yet we elect this bozo that thinks it's a Chinese hoax. Why? Because there's this deeper rhetorical aquifer, this catastrophic aquifer that saps or paralyzes our political will to basically put two and two together. It's happening, but we don't really want to do anything about it. Why not? Because we have this kind of perverse but consistent yearning for catastrophe. And it's particularly important for traditionally marginalized audiences. And we haven't talked about that, but I think that's a pretty important point here, is that if you feel like you once had a firm grip on power, but you don't anymore, and now, you know, your world is a bit shaken, I argue that you're much more likely to be attracted to catastrophic rhetoric, because catastrophic rhetoric is like, it's like a big reset button, that the you know, all this devastating stuff is going to happen, economic and ecological and political.
Yeah, there's been a bunch of stuff with this, like the apocalypse we wanted and the apocalypse we got stuff, and this fantasies of apocalypse and all that jazz. And I'm always like, no oppressed, minoritized person wants an apocalypse, because do you know what happens to women in the apocalypse?
Yes.
I'll tell you, it doesn't look good. So all you people running around talking about the when the wild wild west returns and stuff, right, you're only ever the people who were in power in the first place, and often that is lower socioeconomic class white cis men, right?
Exactly.
Because they're the ones who will survive in the apocalypse, because they are historically the ones who have had the power before technology and social progress, you know, created a leveler playing field.
Yeah.
Great point.
And climate change in particular it's like a sharp knife, and eventually it's going to cut everyone.
Yeah.
But first it's going to cut the disempowered and the most marginalized. And at least in the short term, the traditionally empowered are going to be able to manage it fine. And that's like the perverse attraction to this rhetoric, is that if we do reset hierarchies of power, we'll kind of thin the herd, if you know what I mean. And we'll see who is deserving and who is not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's great stuff. And again, I have had to work really hard. I think you have to think about this stuff the way that we think about it and still feel like, because what's sitting around wallowing about how terrible everything is not productive. It might be true that things are getting worse, but I also am, and I think this is really important, like guilt is not a productive emotion. So for people listening who are in relative positions of power, I mean, you're not the 1%, but you might be the top 50%. And if you look at the poverty threshold, most of us are well above it listening to this podcast right now. Sitting around feeling guilty and bad is exactly what helps conservatism and catastrophe rhetorics keep moving forward, right? You have to have sort of like some kind of, maybe, I don't know, dark optimism. I'm not sure what the word is here, but you need to resist the guilt that is not a productive, and it's optional. The guilt is optional. Mm-hmm. Right? Take your greatest emotional asset is responsibility. That is the word you want. You need to take responsibility. You need to be responsible and responsive. You don't need to feel guilty. You also don't need to feel sunshine and rainbows, but there are things you can do, and your job is to get doing those things, right?
Yes, that's very well said. And the optimistic strand is that we can look back at American history, particularly in the 20th century, and we can see how strong institutions mm-hmm. improved American lives.
Absolutely.
Like you said, not everyone, not equally. It's not like there's a level playing field. That's not what I'm saying.
But on the whole, but on balance.
On the whole. Yeah. On the whole. Mm-hmm. And catastrophe attempts to destroy institutions so that we can return to this Darwinian survival of the fittest. And I love how you put that. Don't let the guilt paralyze you. If this leaves you feeling, you know, if your Twitter feed and if the headlines leave you feeling uneasy,
yeah,
channel that unease into a productive avenue. And the productive avenue for what I argue is rehabilitating and developing strong institutions that can prevent catastrophe rather than accelerate it.
Yeah. And I think another thing that it's sort of a sub thread of the Christian fundamentalism chapter, is one of the cool things about rhetoric is that sometimes you can repurpose discourses for new purposes. And I think that's what like really astute rhetoricians for social change have done. And one of the things about the catastrophe fundamentalist kind of thinking is that it's often paired with a kind of longevity community orientation. And if you can tease out the community common good longevity orientation from the catastrophe, one of the things that we can talk about is that most people think about climate change in terms of their lifetime. And if you think about it like that, of course it doesn't feel particularly like you could, you know, because you're not thinking about long term. But one thing I will say that religion has over secular society is a focus on the long term. And so you can also you can play some of these logics against each other to try to, you know, to get, again, to use Burke, to like reorganize the value system of people that are in your sphere of influence. Like I very often will try to reorganize it. My father's values around gun control, because he has multiple competing values. And my job as a progressive is to try to get him to recognize that like one of his values is trumping, you know, there's a word I don't want to use anymore. a value that he also holds. And so trying to bring that other value so it has more, it gets more airtime in his brain.
Mm, that's good. That, and it reminds me of a similar story featuring a climate scientist at Texas Tech named Catherine mm-hmm. Hale, who mm-hmm. her father was a climate change denier. And she is a climate scientist. And she just banged her head against the wall for years and years and years, trying to convince her own father that climate change was real and that it was happening and it was going to be bad and they should all do something about it. So, I mean, just think about those conversations. She's a climate scientist, PhD, professor at Texas Tech, She goes home for Thanksgiving, and there's her father, who basically repudiates her life's work. And she said that she used to dump all kinds of like computer models and graphs and scientific evidence on him. None of that worked. And at one point she was fed up, and this was some holiday dinner they were having. She played the personal connection card and said, "You know, Dad, I understand why you may not agree with Al Gore, but I'm your daughter, and this is my life's work. Don't you trust me?" And as she's telling the story, she basically said that it, you know, didn't happen right away, but over the next, you know, couple weeks, that whole, you know, "Don't you trust me," led to complete reorientation in her father's thinking. And so I think that's, without getting too individualistic, I think that's an interesting story because it emphasizes the role of trust in community. And so much of catastrophic rhetoric is built on us and them, built on developing others, marginalizing them. So that so much of Trump's rhetoric is built on that. So that one way to remedy that or to come back against it is to try to expand the parameters of your community so that people that you may disagree with, like we talked about earlier, maybe they're not evil. Maybe they are misguided. Maybe they're ignorant. But you can fix ignorance. You can't fix evil. And so if you have that approach, in this case, like to, you know, your family members, but even beyond that, people that you might see in sort of an us-them relationship, if you view the relationship as one of, you know where you can, where you don't dismiss them because they are fundamentally evil, it can lead to much more productive conversations and then much more productive, like, bounds of community.
Yeah, I totally agree. Well, this is one of the disappointing things about these interviews is that these books are so good and you barely get to skim the surface. But we are coming up on time. And number one, my neighbor has decided to mow his lawn for the third time today. So I just wanted to give you a chance. Is there anything in the book that we didn't cover that you really think you really want to make sure the audience takes away with them before we wrap?
There's one useful touchstone. And again, to help us understand our more current historical moment, I draw on Star Wars and the Polar Express and the Emperor with no clothes, these cultural touchstones that all kind of lead up to this idea that belief is the price of admission. Let me see if I can unpack that in a more helpful way. Public policy that improves people's lives needs to be evidence-based. But in a post-truth world, where for particular communities, evidence means little, entrance into that community is predicated upon an expressed disbelief in expertise. And the result, of course, is a president, but more broadly, a party and a political community that wields tremendous influence on public policy without the help of expertise and evidence and data. And I think understanding that is so important to improving our public conversation. Right. So Lee and I, you and I are communication scholars, and we're interested in using better words to improve people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Hashtag use your words.
Use your words. Is that Daniel Tiger?
I know. I think it is, but it's like great advice that no one listens to after they're about 3 years old.
And I think we are going to struggle to have productive conversations across the political spectrum if we don't recognize how evidence, truth, expertise has been reoriented as a community-defining characteristic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did an interview that a couple of months ago with Leslie Hahner and Heather Woods, and they wrote a hilariously titled book, Make America Meme Again.
Yes.
And it's all about Trump's campaign, Trump's 2016 campaign, and the role of memes and anti-evidence in online, sort of like subversive online, what they call like lulz community, which is kind of like these ironic, trolly kind of message board sort of people. And yeah, exactly what you're talking about, how we forget that evidence, right? That evidence, or what you think of evidence, or how you think of expertise, or what counts as expertise, these become new guardians for who belongs where and what kind of knowledge penetrates their aquifer, yeah. Right?
That's a good way to put it. Kind of guardians at the gate, like the price of admission.
Yeah, exactly like you said. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great point. And again, this is one of those books that every chapter was better than the last chapter. It all kind of leads to a couple of really strong takeaways, which made it a great read. And also it brought some things to light, ways of thinking about popular issues that I hadn't considered before. So I highly recommend it. Again, I've been interviewing Luke Winslow, author of American Catastrophe, Fundamentalism, Climate Change, Gun Rights, and the Rhetoric of Donald J. Trump, from Ohio State University Press. And I'm so excited to announce that the great and wonderful Ohio State University Press has been gracious enough to provide temporary, for the pandemic, free access to books, including American Catastrophe, through their BiblioVault scholarly repository. And if you are not part of an institution that has access, the book is very reasonably priced as an electronic version, and I love to recommend that if you have the means, grab a copy of the book, take it to your local library, and put it into circulation so that lots of people can get access to this work, and also you can support the university presses that don't make very much money, and I don't know if you know this, but academic authors make almost nothing on these books. But we want work like Luke's to get out there, and we want it to get out there with the kind of attention and skill that only university presses can provide. So with that, Luke, do you want to say anything about where everyone can get in touch with you, or what kinds of projects you're working on now?
Well, first, let me say thank you for those kind words, Lee. That was very nice. I wrote an op-ed in the Waco Tribune that came out last week. If people are interested in seeing how the arguments in this book, the arguments that we just talked about, are more directly connected to the corona pandemic, they can find that op-ed. It's wacotrib.com. I'm actually not on, this is something I need to redress as I try to drum up publicity here. I'm not on social media. So the best way to email me, best way to get a hold of me would be to email me.
Email?
At winslowluke@gmail.com. So my last name and my first name, winslowluke@gmail.com. And in terms of current projects, I'm working on a third book on, it's called American Oligarchy and Ooh. The Twilight of Liberal Democracy. Ooh. And what I'm trying to do is, in some ways it's connected to this, what we've just been talking about. I'm trying to get us to think deeply about the value of the words we use to describe our economic and political relationship, particularly words like neoliberalism and conservatism and libertarianism, seem to be unable to explain the dominance of people like the Koch brothers on our political economy. So that's a book that is 110,000 words right now. It's way too long. And so I'm in kind of the process of chopping that down and polishing that up. But that is a project that I'm really excited about.
Well, that's great. And as a person who reads a ton of books, I always say they're ultimately all going to boil down to this hour interview. So anything we didn't talk about in this interview theoretically didn't need to go in the book. So being a public intellectual has really taught me a lot about playing a little faster and looser. But maybe you got two books there. Who knows, right?
Yeah.
Well, and I read... Go ahead.
Well, I read a writer say that, a good writer can make it look easy, but that's only because the writer has basically cut out all the crap. And so, if you have 110,000 words, maybe you actually have 40,000 words that are worthwhile.
Well, actually, interestingly enough, have you ever heard the writing advice, kill your darlings?
Yes.
most people think that that means kill off your favorite main characters. But it actually originated meaning kill off the sentence, like delete the sentences you think are the best because they're often just like overly inflated, right? And so I always thought that was funny because a lot of us just, we get very attached to our sentences.
Let me recommend a book helped me in that sense.
I'm going to write this down. What do
you got? Joe Moran, Moran, wrote a short little accessible book, and it's called First You Write a Sentence. And he talks about killing your darlings, and he...
Up on my pro tip. Oh, dang. I got to get some material.
He shows you like not just why to do it, but how. And it's lovely, not just for academics, but for anyone who wants to improve their, written communication.
Oh, I will check it out. I'm always looking to become a better writer, even though, to most people, I'm probably really good. But to me, it's just one of those never-ending crafts.
Yes.
Is it March 28th editorial, just what we need in a pandemic crisis for Waco Trib? Is that you?
No.
Mine, okay, good, because your name is nowhere on this thing.
Mine came out, it was Sunday before last.
It's real new. Okay, I'll keep looking for it because I just wanted to let readers know. I will link to the show notes. Do you want to say anything else? Because I want to be respectful of their time and also the lawnmower. So any final thoughts before we say goodbye?
I think that's it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah. And Luke, I can't thank you enough. I can't imagine what a trial and tribulation getting through this book was, not only for the quality of the writing, but also just the depth of the complexity of the ideas and some of the, like we have talked about, doom and gloom moments. And you've brought something really valuable to the world. And thank you for coming on and doing this interview. We appreciate it so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yep. All right, listeners, it was great chatting again. This is Luke Winslow and the book American Catastrophe, fresh off the presses, 2020. Definitely check it out. And we will see you in the next episode of New Books Network.